Hey there, Ghosties. Welcome to episode 101, finally, of the Ghost Lights podcast. I know it's been a while, but I'm glad you're back with us. Today, we have the special guest, Samuel Rose. We talked about their journey, what started, what sparked their career in the arts, how it's changed, how important it is, and the idea of transferring that bigger-than-you quality to the audience through the work. And now, War by the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. Ghosties, welcome back. Episode 101. I'm rusty as hell, so hopefully this goes well. Our first episode back from a long hiatus after reaching 100, where I dropped a bomb on the move to Albuquerque, which with every passing day, capitalist governments, taxes tell me this is what you need to do because ain't nobody fighting for anybody. Samuel Rose,
hey!
Everybody!
Hey!
What's going on? How about that for an introduction, huh?
Love it. Yeah. Love when my name is connected with capitalism.
Right?
My
Who does
BFF.
It?
Yeah.
Besties.
Oh, we're tight.
So in your writer, it said only yellow M&Ms. I'm sorry I have no M&Ms.
Yeah. That's fucked up.
Well, I brought it upon myself.
You did.
I did.
To our credit, we didn't give you any other color.
True.
That's true. There are no in M&Ms. Fact, zero M&Ms.
There are zero M&Ms.
So in a way...
We don't even have a
writer,
so I guess we're doing good.
We're in compliance with the strikes, for sure.
We are, yeah. No one is getting preferential treatment here, or any treatment.
Or any treatment at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I do have a sparkling cherry limeade seltzer, so
yes.
That's pretty nice.
Today's unofficial sponsor is brought to you by Waterloo Cherry Limeade Seltzer. When you want club soda, drink Waterloo when it's on sale. $4.69 at King Soopers.
Oh, thank you, King Soopers.
All right, Kroger. You son of a gun. There's your plug. Now pay me. So, Samuel.
Yeah.
Tell me, theater, how did it happen to you?
Yeah, that's a really big question. And my answer is sort of a multi-step process. It all started... when I was probably 12 or 13 years old,
okay. And
I got a massive crush on Keira Knightley.
Cheers.
Yes, the beginning of many a bisexual tale. And I memorized all of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies that were out at the time, which was two of them, and then three later.
Yes.
And I would force my friends to watch me act out the scenes as all of the characters.
Arrogant diva energy.
Arrogant diva energy, for sure.
Hashtag.
Yes, that's me. And I would make them watch me act out all of these scenes as all of the characters, many of whom I should not have been playing. And
you can play anyone you want to.
Wow. Thanks, Sam Gilstrap. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the episode.
No, there's definitely more to come. And sure, it's a more complicated dialogue. Don't at me. Keep going.
So there was no theater program in my middle school. So there was no...
What?
I know. Yeah, I know. God. Creighton Middle School.
Creighton.
And I didn't really have like an appropriate outlet for this expressive art form that I was discovering I really wanted to do. So I continued to torture my friends until I had... very few friends remaining in middle school, except for the super cool ones, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to high school, and I had no idea how to audition for things, how to do a monologue, what a monologue even was. I, of course, auditioned with a monologue from Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah, you did.
For the first play that I ever auditioned for.
Which one? What was the monologue?
Oh, you know, the one where she's like, "Gentlemen, hoist the colors," you know.
Oh.
That's like the inspirational, like...
You know, that's not enough to jog my memory. Can you...
We begin.
And scene.
I actually don't remember
any
of it. I'm sorry. Other than like those few words.
Gentlemen, let's begin.
Yes. All and it didn't go so hot, as you can imagine. Although, to be honest, if I were directing and I saw a ninth grader get up there and, like, 110% go for a Keira Knightley impression, I would have been like, you're fucking hired. But that was not what happened to me. So I ended up auditioning for lots of shows, never getting cast in high school. Saw a lot of cast lists without my name on it. And I was like, dang, this is a sad feeling of rejection that I will definitely internalize for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I started taking classes at the Denver Center and was given a lot of tools there to actually learn how to audition for things and how to do this acting thing other than just like impressions and copy pasting other people's choices. And it was amazing. And so when I was like 16, I got cast as Juliet in a production of Romeo and Juliet that was a class, like a summer class. And it changed my life. Shout out Allison Watrous, who cast me in that. And it was the first time that I really experienced being like grounded and present, like so present that I surprised myself on stage a couple times. And then I was addicted from that moment on.
What was it about that presence? Like you touched on this thing that as a 16-year-old that you yourself are admitting was a surprise. Mm-hmm. How did that feel differently than what you did normally?
I think normally, and I think this is something I still sometimes struggle with as an actor, and maybe other actors can relate, but sort of having an idea in your head of choices that you want to make rather than being so, I guess, in a Meisner-esque way, immersed in the scene that you're just responding. I think before that moment, I had experienced like having a plan and then executing the plan on stage. And I think this was the first moment where I had made this plan. The plan was the work that I had done to prepare, which is important for all actors to do. But then the moment that I stepped on stage, I think I trusted that the work would be there rather than thinking about it each step of the way. And so I remember specifically the scene. It's like the morning after scene. Romeo and Juliet, very appropriate play for high schoolers.
Trust me, the Family Guy bit about Romeo and Juliet is quite hysterical.
It's quite, yeah, I need to see
it. It's quite awesome. Yeah.
So we're in this morning after scene, right?
Yeah.
Me and this other kid who also turned out to be gay, who was playing Romeo. And there's a moment where he's like, I'ma leave. And Juliet's like, no, the morning lark. It's not the morning lark. It's the nightingale. Like, stay. You're fine. It's totally still nighttime.
Subtext is, I'm still horny.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Indeed. And so.
There you go. There you go, Dan.
Dan gets it now. Yeah. Dan finally understands.
You can put away the book. You can put away the script. It's fine.
Yeah.
As you were saying.
Okay. I get Shakespeare now.
There you go. That's pretty much all of it. Anyway.
Right.
Keep going.
So Romeo's like, no, I better leave. I'm like, banish it and all that. And Juliet, I just remember I had this moment of, I think we had choreographed a hug, but like, I don't really remember. Like looking back, I just remember that like.
You didn't have an intimacy choreographer at this time?
In the year of our Lord, 2009, we did not have an intimacy choreographer. You know, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. We have learned things. Anyway,
totes.
It was a hug. It's
totes.
Fine. So I just remember like running at him and hugging him and feeling like my life depended on it. Like I finally actually like dropping into like the stakes of the scene and being kind of overcome with the given circumstances and everything. And I was just like, whoa, like just free falling. Emotions were coming up, but they weren't being forced and they weren't being like pre-planned. And it was, I've never felt so powerful. And I've been chasing that high ever since, y'all. But really that was the beginning, I think, of my healing process with a lot of the rejection that I had experienced up until that point. And like the beginning of a buildup of my self-worth as an artist that feels like the journey that I'm still on and constantly on, because we work in an industry that, especially as actors, tells you you're not good enough and you won't be enough, et cetera, et cetera. Capitalism is a big part of that too, of course, because people are like, we're trying to make a product for consumption, for audiences. But yeah, it was really, honestly, a very healing moment and a very expansive moment for me as a young person. So then I went on to major in theater in college, And I ended up transferring halfway through. And the second university that I went to had a pretty strong program in devised theater. Mm. So I was only there for one semester, but I took, well, I was there for three semesters total. But my first semester, I took a voice and movement class, which was very Linklater based. And that was also a huge clarifying moment for me as an artist, because I was like, oh, it doesn't have to be so heady. I'm not one of those people who can do like paperwork and feel like that drops me into a role, because I'm like, well, I'm not going to go on stage and write an essay. Like, that's not a way that makes sense to my brain to prepare. So this was one of the first classes that I took where it was all about embodiment and embodying voice movement, and opening and like expanding. Mm-hmm. And that class combined with a devised theater class that I took later was very life-changing as well, in terms of like being a fully embodied artist. Mm. So not just an actor, but someone who can fully in three dimensions make art. Mm. That is performance or, you know, whatever you want to call it, but
yeah.
And then I studied abroad in Russia for a semester, and that was a real game changer. That was amazing. RIP to the NTI American Theater School at the Moscow Art Theater. There's a little bit of a hashtag war going on right now. I don't know if you've heard about it.
Yeah.
Thought it was just a land dispute.
No. It's still going on.
I thought Putin was just fighting Nazis in Ukraine.
No. As you were saying.
Yes. Russia was bananas bonkers, as you can
imagine.
Did
you meet Bert Kreischer? No, I'm kidding.
I wish. No, I did have an acting professor who used to date Elizabeth Olsen when he was a student, and she was also studying abroad there. So that was fun.
Fantastic.
Yeah. He was incredible. He would always give us direction, like, instead of saying that, like, oh, stakes should be higher, you should be, like, terrified in this moment. He would be like, here you are a little bit pooping.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah, it was incredible.
I like that. That's a good measurement.
Yeah,
of stake.
Here you are a little bit pooping. Just a
that's
little.
Right. This is you, lot of pooping.
A lot of pooping.
A lot of pooping.
Yes.
Much online. Lot of pooping, and you are 5 feet from bathroom door.
In your way, other actor, go.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. That's right. Out of the way, Bernice!
Yeah, it was awesome. And it was, I think it was my first exposure, or at least one of my only exposures to theater outside of the U.S. Mm-hmm. That was also, like, very eye-opening, because American theater is so entrenched in realism, becoming a little bit less so, but definitely still at that time, for sure, it was like a lot of like living room drama and like John Patrick Shanley, like we love him, but it was a lot of him. And Russia, like the crazy thing was, I shouldn't say crazy, bananas, the bananas thing was, we would see things like Streetcar Named Desire, but like in Russian, performed by Russian people, a play that you would think is like extremely American, and it would be a lot less realism vibes than in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There would be like sort of like dream sequency breaks and things like that. Or seeing Shakespeare there, like I saw this production of King Lear that was just like so entrenched in like motif and symbolism, and like there were silent moments that would go on for like minutes that would be almost like a movement sequence to like deepen into characters, which was very much in alignment with our training there, which was very based on what we called etudes. So
etudes,
an etude, yes, etude is French for moment. And so we would make every day, we had to make a different etude. We were studying Cherry Orchard in our class, so we would have to make etudes based on the Cherry Orchard. And there was one day where they sat us down, because we kept making these little, like, American realism scenes about the Cherry Orchard. And they were like, what the fuck is happening? And
there's no pooping.
There's no pooping. There's no mysticism. But they really did, like, tear into us a bit about the lack of mysticism, and they were like, Ranevskaya just said she saw the ghost of her mother, and we were like, yeah, well, she's like you know, got a screw loose, or, you know, I was a little dissociated right now. And they'd be like, or she just saw the ghost of her mother. Mm. And we were like, oh, got it. Okay, lean into the mysticism. Understood. Mm. And so that introduced a lot more layers of, like, the magic that you can have, and also the power that you have as a theater maker of creating any rules you want to, mm-hmm. as long as you're consistent and the audience will buy into it. Yeah. So you just have to be clear. You have to know what the rules are. You can literally make up any rule in the world, right?
Like, it's like playing a game with a child, basically.
Yes, yeah. Which is why we do this, mm-hmm. because it's really like playing pretend. And I think that that's an appeal for a lot of us. We play pretend very professionally, mm-hmm. and seriously, totally. Right? But like in a very silly way, like that is kind of what we're doing. And I think in the US especially, we've lost touch with that in a lot of ways. Like it's very much become that like make the art for the consumer, like we were talking about earlier. But like really it's about play and imagination and expanse. And that is like what theater can do from an activism perspective as well, that we have this power to imagine that things could be different. Mm-hmm. And I think like exploring that is what keeps me in theater's grip. That was a really long answer to your question.
No, it's perfect. It's I mean, the journey that you're on, I'm on, that whoever's listening, my ghosties at home.
Ghosties.
It's ghosties, baby. It's
Renevskaya's mom. Shout out.
That's right. Wherever you are. I hope you're not pooping.
Just a little bit.
Just a little. Anyway. We've got wipes for it. I'm trying to get focused here. The journey that we're on, the journey that we're on, like it's hard. It's always hard to put into context, especially to the uninitiated. I would say that people that are not pursuing some level of artistic expression as their main driver, either financially, spiritually, whatever it is that moves you. Like if that's not your focus, it's hard for me to explain it to my friends. And mm-hmm. I think here amongst, especially like we've had conversations, but I don't know that it's okay to take that time and explain it that way, especially because I've got an experience with you working on a children's theater piece, mm-hmm. and was able to sit back and watch some of your mind kind of tackle the piece and see that there's an incredibly smart person there. I kind of viewed you as like analytical mind. And then when you started talking about, you know, how far you could find it in your body and mm-hmm. your voice, how much of that opened up the way you look at your performance. And while there's a number of questions from what you just went over that hopefully I'll remember and we'll get into, the first one that jumps into mind, where do you find yourself at this stage in your career the most comfortable on stage?
Yeah, that's a great question, especially as I am shifting a little bit away from acting and more into the directing realm. But I personally don't like to turn off those parts of my brain when I'm an actor.
Which parts?
The director parts and the creator parts. The, like, holistic embodied artist parts. Mm-hmm. Because it all contributes to my process, if that makes sense. Like,
absolutely.
Lights and sound and costume and all these things are part of the creation of the character. It's why tech is sometimes the most painful part of a process, but also the most exciting, because that's when it all kind of comes together. So for me right now as a performer, what excites me is continuing to strive for that, like, being present and being holistic and sort of being that person who like takes the leap off the cliff and trusts that all the work that I've done is going to catch me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you find being mindful of the whole makes staying connected to the moment difficult at times?
I think it depends. I think in rehearsal mm-hmm. it can. Because it can sometimes take you out of being present with your scene partners.
Totally.
On stage, when all of those elements are there, I find the opposite is true, and that it's very helpful for me. That, like, feeling the energy of the light design is something that I can connect with, like, kinesthetically as an actor to carry me into the momentum and connect with my scene partner and be more present, not just with them, but also with the world of the play.
Definitely. So now, as you're transitioning more into a directorial space, do you find that that focus has been, is that focus is what driving you wanting to be a director? Or is it, or is there another side of this that we haven't touched on yet?
That's a great question. In all honesty, I really was blocking myself from directing for a very long time. And part of the reason for that is because I had a professor early on who told me that I was too smart to be an actor and that I should be a director instead, as though those things are exclusive, or as though actors can't be smart, or as though, yeah. So I think
just
for a long
time,
in a very like Torian grudge holding way, I was like, I'm going to prove him wrong and show that I can be an actor. I can do it, Dad. And so I kind of like shut off the part of myself for a long time that was interested in directing, because I do think very much in images. And so that translates really well to directing, because it is very much like three-dimensional. And I think that now part of the interest in returning to directing is more so in like reclaiming my power as an artist and sort of reclaiming that narrative for myself and being like, I can be all of the things. I do not have to choose. I can be a person who directs and acts and writes. I can be a person first. And these are like the things that I do. Like, acting doesn't have to be my identity. Directing doesn't have to be my identity. And it doesn't have to be like exclusive to the other things that I want to explore.
Picking one does not validate existence.
I know, it's wild. Yeah, but it's true. I mean, I think that like I really internalized for a long time that like, oh, if I wasn't acting, then like, who was I? Who am I going to be? Because since the time I was 12, 13, whatever, I had decided that this is who I was going to be. And I created my identity around that. And I think that finally, as an adult, getting to a stage where I'm like, no, I don't have to be like that. I can like, you know, yeah, I can actually like just be a person who creates art, because that's who we all are. I think anyone at any skill level, that's all we're trying to do is like be expressive and try to communicate our inner worlds through whatever medium makes the most sense at the time.
Going back to your experiences in Russia, being seeing the stark, probably, differences between their mode of storytelling and what you grew up with here, what draws you to that mystic side, for lack of a better word, and how do you feel that your experiences and as a performer in both places can help you as a, like down the road with your career? Like, how do you want to pull mesh, if that's even something you're looking to do?
Yeah, I think it's something that has already happened subconsciously. Wow.
Keep going.
For audiences who missed this moment, Sam Gilstrap just slapped his pumpkin spice iced latte
that
against his microphone. Oh, that wiped my memory. What was the question again? Oh, it was about how I incorporate.
Right, so here's the question. Rank the Pirates of the Caribbean cast members 1 through 10. Go.
Pass.
Coward is a stinky cologne.
I mean, we can retitle the episode to Coward.
Coward, no. All right. Anyway,
Semmelrose, Denver's most famous coward.
Oh, no. Keep going.
Okay.
No, more specifically.
Yes.
Through your experiences in Russia, here in America, looking at both sides of how they do storytelling, respectively, what are some of the things that you like that you want to pull and in, and have that influence your work as you go forward? And do you think there are things that we can't do here in America that they do easily and vice versa?
Yeah. Yes. I'm going to answer the second part of your question first.
Cool.
Yes. Russia has a much easier time making experimental and devised and like let's fuck with public domain shit type theater, because it's state funded. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the artists who work on those shows, they're salaried. It is their career to be in the same repertory of shows for decades. Mm. And they have years to develop theater, and it's so much more resourced. Like, they have not only the artists being resourced through income, but they also have the institutions and they have the money for production value. So I think that, like, devised and experimental theater here in the US, the biggest difference is lack of resources. Mm-hmm. And even with theater that is not experimental and devised, we are seeing all over the country how many theaters are finding that the current model is unsustainable.
Yeah.
Because having such a high overhead cost and not enough patron support to make up for that level of cost is not a sustainable model. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in the US, there's very little choice if you're going to make things at that high of a production value, because the government does not support it mm-hmm. at nearly the same level. There's a downside to that, though, in Russia, which is when someone, say, decides to invade Ukraine, then artists have to have a moment of, oh, shit, does this paycheck align with my values? Because this paycheck is coming from the government. I'm a government employee, essentially. So if I accept this paycheck, am I endorsing? And also, there's way more laws and censorship mm-hmm. about what can be on stage.
Yeah.
In Soviet Russia, there was, like, a ton of workarounds with mm-hmm. that. Like, people used, especially, like, children and puppets, theater and fairy tales as a way to subvert regimes mm-hmm. and criticize regimes in ways that were just subtle enough to get, like, past censorship, but also be, like, fairly clear in messaging. But yeah, there's pros and cons mm-hmm. to government sponsorship of the arts in that way.
Totally.
So I think, in a sense, on the same scale, could America ever make theater the way that Russia does? No, not until something systemically massively changes, whether that's government putting a lot more resources into arts and artists being more holistically salaried to develop new work or what. Mm-hmm. But something would need to be different for that to be possible. I recently devised a show at Buntport Theater, and we devised a pretty awesome show in about 6 weeks that was exploring some of the mysticism and things that I picked up in Russia, and definitely exploring, like, world building and movement as a way to tell story, and not just text, not mm-hmm. text being, like, elevated above all the other elements of theater. But it was really challenging for me and my ensemble, mostly because I was not resourced to do theater at the scale that would actually, like, facilitate that vision fully and have everyone feel taken care of. So for me, speaking from my end, it was a lot of, like, up till 3 a.m., up at 6 a.m., not enough time to eat, not enough time to sleep for several weeks in order to pull it off and make it happen. Mm-hmm. Did we do it? Yes. Could it have been more than it was if we were more resourced? Also, yes. But one of the things that I have also taken away from the combination of the American and Russian theater training backgrounds is that something that in America especially happens, and I guess maybe in Russia too, there is sort of a colonialist, capitalist separation of people from their own resources to create. And so something I'm interested in continuing to bring forward with devising work especially is reuniting people with their own power mm-hmm. to create stuff. Mm. Like, sure, it's really awesome to see stuff in these big proscenium stages with thousands of seats. And also making
millions of seats,
billions of seats.
That's right.
There's also, like, art that you can make anywhere with almost no resources that is just as valid, that can be just as powerful, as long as you are, like, in attunement with how you're telling the story and being consistent. Absolutely. And I do think that being in touch with that mysticism is part of it, because I think that, like, that's another thing we're often cut off from is mm-hmm. like our connection to spirituality, whatever that is. I'm not a religious person, to be clear, but for me, like thinking about like the spiritual in relation to theater, like theater has always felt very sacred to me in a way that is almost spiritual, that I think is about like being that vessel for something that is bigger than yourself, mm-hmm. and bringing it, like being a conduit for something that you can't even quite name, mm-hmm. to bring it to people.
Yeah.
And so I think that is something that will always have me in his grasp also.
Nice.
Yeah.
You talked about theater as a form of activism.
Mm-hmm.
And as we asked you how theater kind of happened to you during this time.
Yeah.
My first question is, theater as we knew it, what hampers that form of performance in terms of connecting a truth? Like if you're doing a piece about some social matter that really needs to be addressed or we're not talking about enough, and you're trying to draw eyes,
mm-hmm.
does the distance from a proscenium stage hamper that delivery? And if so, can we ever bridge that gap without being too... I guess the phrase would be heavy-handed or preachy, which seems to be enough to draw people away or at least go like, oh,
yeah.
You're telling me how to think.
Yeah. I do think it's important as artists to not be preachy. Mm-hmm. I think that the important thing as artists is to be asking questions genuinely.
Yeah.
So to use Willie Nicky as an example again, I had to start marketing the show before the show existed, mm-hmm. because of the timeline of the way that process worked. And so initially when I started marketing it, I was like, it's an anti-imperialist drag play, which sounds quite preachy. Anti-imperialist is a strong stance. But what ended up happening in the room and in process was much more an exploration of the impacts of imperialism. And the question that the ensemble asked that we explored through the play was, what are they distracting us from?
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that never really had a consistent answer, but we were always asking the question. So I think that making sure you're being question oriented and not didactic is important, even and maybe especially in activist circles. Because I think as soon as you get didactic, you run the risk of getting a little fascist, right? A little bit like, well, if you don't think like I think, then you're not one of us.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to exclude you, right? But if you are genuinely asking questions, then you are reminded constantly of like the work you still have to do inside of yourself, because you exist in these systems also and have taken on all of us. Every single person has taken on like aspects or traits from these systems that are in this constant loop of like, we are a product of the system and we uphold the system as individuals. And it's just that wheel that keeps turning. So the way to disrupt it is to be like, oh, what can I disrupt within me and myself as an artist? Mm. So when it comes to like prosceniums and really large scale theater, I do think that like the institution of theater as it exists right now,
is it too lecture based?
I don't know if it's lecture-y so much as it feels masturbatory sometimes. Mm. Like, I think if we're like asking ourselves, like, I don't know, I can't think of a play. Let's say that there's a play that's like abortion bad, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe the opposite. Not being able to access abortion bad, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
There we go. We got there. Uh-huh. Not being able to access abortion bad, right? Which could be a bumper sticker. But when you take it and you make it a play that knows that its message is that people not having access to abortion is bad, and with the marketing, you know you're going to attract an audience that already agrees with that messaging,
mm-hmm.
and because of economics, an audience that probably has plenty of access to abortion regardless of what state they live in,
mm-hmm.
then it is just a masturbatory exercise for us to pat ourselves on the back and feel like we're super good people because we got to tell this white, liberal, wealthy audience that not being able to access abortion bad, which they already knew, and already doesn't impact them nearly the way it impacts most people. So it's an interesting conundrum, and I think we're at a cool time in the industry, despite there also being a lot of like, I don't know what word is right. Death is the first word that came to my mind, but I don't mean literal death. I mean like death.
Dearth?
dearth, the dearth of the industry. but the changes in the industry that we're seeing and like the institutions that are finding it no longer sustainable to continue in certain models. Mm-hmm. I think it's an awesome opportunity for us as an industry to really interrogate what it is we're doing here and why. Because if we are just going to be didactic to audiences that already agree with our messaging, mm-hmm. then why not work for a corporation and at least get paid a little more and get some benefits? So I think that it's a really awesome time for mm-hmm. us to be asking these questions and being like, well, what is it that keeps calling me back to making theater? Mm. And how can I be like in service of other people in my community, as well as these stories that I want to be a conduit for mm-hmm. in order to disrupt these systems and make the world a little bit better?
Do you feel that that's like a calling for you specifically?
I think so, but I don't know. Mm. I think that like it's something I think about a lot. I feel like the calling is maybe more visceral than that. Because I feel like I've tried to get away from theater so many times where I'm like, it's not financially sustainable for me, right? Like, mm-hmm. I keep hitting these periods of having to, like, work at a grocery store for 2 months or whatever in between contracts, and it sucks. And taking jobs that are just, like, shitty and have shitty bosses and don't pay well, and then being so hungry for these opportunities in theater that carry me for like 2 to 3 months and then the cycle has to repeat. Mm-hmm. I think that like the calling for me is much more just like, for some reason, very simply, I just can't stop doing it.
Yeah.
Maybe one day I'll get to a point where I'm like, and that's good. I'm done. Mm-hmm. Let's put that theater on the shelf. Yes.
Yeah. And scene. Yeah.
Right. Well, and my in-laws down. Can stop asking me if I'm still doing that theater thing. But we're not there yet.
At least it's question based.
Yeah, that's true. You're right.
That's right. Interesting. No, I think you're right. I've been saying it for like the last year. I feel like the theater that I learned in college at Metro won't be there. It'll change. I'm not saying it's going away and that the people that are doing it right now in preceding stages are like are not doing worthwhile stuff. I'm saying it's going to change. It's going to be different. And so I have been trying really hard to like learn a flexibility within the world, because I really love realism. Like, I really am connected to that. And of late, I've tried to learn more about, you know, how to tell a realistic story through an immersive lens, really. Mm-hmm. That's been a lot of the work. The last three shows outside of the children's thing have been close to, if
Edward
not...
Edward Tulane wasn't realistic?
It was realistic for me. I'm saying it wasn't immersive. Yeah.
We should have thrown the rabbit at the children.
I mean, I don't know why...
And you can quote me on that. I'm just...
What I wanted was... I wanted all of our box office staff to wear rabbit costumes and come down the aisles when kids were making catcalls and booing us. Because fuck them kids.
Wait, but... we're never getting hired back here.
That's fine.
It's
okay.
It wasn't
enough money. It was a great time. I had a great time, but it wasn't enough.
The words being expressed are not the views of Denver Children's Theater.
Are you thinking like those scary Easter Bunny costume memes?
Yeah, no, terrible. You know, like with Donnie Darko masks?
Yes.
And instead of them just coming down the aisle, they just appear at random yeah. intervals throughout the show and point at the one that's talking.
And each one of them has a removable limb that they come up and pop off.
If one,
the
if
child.
One of them pops off during wow. me dressing the bunny, absolutely. Absolutely. I've derailed this once again, something I'm really good at. But honestly, I feel like it has to change.
Yes.
I feel like so often we want a consumer. I'm speaking in terms of consumer now. Mm-hmm. Me as the consumer, I want an experience. I want a reason to put my phone down. Give me something better than TikTok. Give me something better
good
than YouTube.
Good luck, because that comes with a lot of dopamine.
Dude, for sure. For sure.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm with it. There's this thing called Chuck the Bird or Chad the Bird then it's this puppet bird at a bar in Chicago that just tells stories from the news that he's like written in like really beautiful prose.
Wow.
And makes jokes while he does it.
So this is what our ancestors wanted.
Yeah, exactly. They wanted a man who was serving beer and wine with a hand up a puppet's bird, a puppet bird butt and tell these stories. And I love him. He's hysterical. I also watch the S&B mowing guy clean up these lawns for free. And I'm going like,
and how do we beat that? As an industry.
But no, I mean, no, I don't. But honestly, an experience, something that is more than just me turning on a TV, more mm-hmm. than just me forking over like now $35 to sit in a recliner seat and watch The Equalizer 3, a movie that I loved. Like, I loved that movie. That was great. That's great fun for me. But I also know that I love going to see shows. I used to really get a kick out of it. Then the lockdown happened, and I was like, well, if I don't need to go sit down in a space, I'm probably not going to go. Now I mm-hmm. look for my actors, my favorite performers, and I want to go see them mm-hmm. to create something. But what I want them to do is, like, have a etude about something powerful, something mm-hmm. meaningful. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be told, lend me a tenor anymore. I don't want to be told, like, Shakespeare's great. Shakespeare's taught me a lot. Shakespeare is a foundational point of artistic storytelling, of theater. I'm not taking anything away, but we can do more digging. And I think another part of theater as a form of activism is, think of all the voices that write stories mm-hmm. that we don't pull from.
Mm-hmm.
That have written quality things. And we're just, I don't want to say lazy, although in my more angry moments, I will say that that's how I look at it.
Mm-hmm.
We're not looking because it's lazy. Mm-hmm. I am not writing the story about Manuelito and the long walk because I'm exhausted when I'm getting home from the bar. The last thing I'm thinking mm-hmm. of is sit down and write this movie.
Like, right.
I'm not even... Oh, there's no way. I don't mm-hmm. want to do the research.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to know about the. I don't want to like dig up the numbers on how many people
right.
suffered on this. And that's scratching at something, right? I'm just thinking about telling a story that might educate people about a part of history that we don't talk about anymore.
Right.
And we see the repercussions of it later. I'm getting a little more me focused, and I apologize. But I mean, when the lockdown happened and the Navajo reservation had the highest death rate per capita at like a large portion of the pandemic, it was like, this is because we've forgotten our history.
Mm-hmm.
We buried these people metaphorically and literally in certain cases, and usually in mass graves, and we're doing it again. And we were doing it in New York, mm-hmm. and we were doing it in so many places across this country. I say New York specifically because I had a guest on our show, Mackenzie, talk about things that she witnessed. She's awesome. She witnessed these horrible things outside mm-hmm. of her window. And it's part of the history that we will probably forget if we don't document it and share it. And are these things horrible? Yes. Is it unfair? Yes. But for the people who had to live through it, they can't forget.
Mm-hmm.
And you demanding that I ease up on teaching history is an extension of that horrible thing, that horrible act. And I want theater to ask more questions without becoming didactic, to your point. Because I think that's a huge point. It's so often we talk about why can't we agree. It's because no matter which side of the aisle we're on, we feel attacked by the other side. It's hard to have a conversation. And when theater's at its best, there's a conversation that's being had. And if we can have that conversation with the audience as well as our scene partner,
mm-hmm.
now we're doing something special. Now we're creating.
And internally with ourselves,
exactly.
too, right?
Yeah, and I think, and it is a conduit. I feel the same way. You touched on some things that I was like, oh, yeah. I mean, ask my acting coach, Sheila Traister, who I love to death. I hope you're doing well.
We love you, Sheila.
We do love you. She saw right through me in one of my first acting classes. And she was like, you're thinking too much about the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing the story, not the moment. You're thinking about how do I get to the end mm-hmm. without knowing what this scene's about. And I still do that every time I get a script. That's the first thing I do is I read through all of my stuff and I think about what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that point on, I just try to get memorized one scene after another so I can throw out the script and be present for that. This isn't a question. I'm not trying to tell a story about my process. My apologies.
Oh my God. No, please don't be sorry.
But it's the, that's my focus. So like hearing that, I'm like, oh, good. A scene. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. The conduit aspect of this, it is for me in a lot of ways as close as I get to a spiritual thing. This is my cathedral.
Yeah.
For all the trash talking I just did about Denver theaters, Denver Children's Theater, like,
I
was floored. I was floored when I got to perform in this space.
Yeah.
It was awesome. It was an awesome experience for a 39-year-old man to have this moment I hadn't been in a theater since a theater built like this, probably since the Eugenia Rawls. And I was Charles the Wrestler.
Mm-hmm.
And then like Forest Servant number 2 in As You Like It. And that was it. So these moments in these spaces are still really powerful for me. And I kiss the stage every time I'm in a performance space that I can do that, because it's an honor for me to be in here. And for you to have that type of, it's bigger than me mindset, to see the whole, to have that presence of mind that you want that bigger than me quality to also be reflected through the work.
That's
awesome. Do you feel that that is supported within the community?
Within the Denver community specifically?
Sure. At this time, yeah. This is where we are.
I would say yes and. The yes is I have encountered a lot of people in the Denver theater community, and this is a large reason why I moved back after 8 years in Portland, who are incredibly generous with their knowledge, with their time, and just with their energy in a way that I haven't experienced as much in other theater communities outside of the context of like specifically people being educators mm-hmm. and that being their job.
Mm-hmm.
I also think an interesting thing about the Denver theater community in particular is that, and this is a completely like outside in, like looking in, I don't have any knowledge of like any theater's working budget. I haven't done that research, but it seems to be well resourced financially compared to other theater communities, but those resources don't seem to be equally distributed in a way that actually empowers a variety of theater makers to take care of themselves, let alone the work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I would love to see the Denver theater community be more of a community in that way and less of like various pockets all over the place, kind of taking care of their own institution. I would love to see people increase their sense of like interdependency in the industry here generally.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of like really great work that people are never going to see, that is never going to get made, simply because people like you were talking about are going to be too tired coming home from their day job to actually be able to do the thing.
Mm.
And it sucks because we live in this like capitalist system that is impossible or feels impossible right now to escape from, that institutions also have to be under.
Mm.
But I think that maybe from like a bottom-up perspective, there is opportunity for us to like support each other and resource each other and take care of each other in ways that systems are never going to do, because systems don't care about us.
Absolutely.
And even institutions aren't going to do, because institutions don't care about us.
Well, they're part of the system.
They're part of the system.
Yeah. 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 I want to transition away from... Excellent points. I think you're absolutely right on a lot of that. I want to make sure that I first acknowledge that. But one of the things I do want to touch on, through as the world has changed and as your perspective on your place as an artist has changed, because I'm sure it has, what are the things that maybe not specifically for you in the moment as you're helping creating, as you're devising a work, as you're leading the charge on something, or as you're getting your notes and then you're taking it the next day, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. What are some of the things that still bring that, oh shit, Keira Knightley is crushing that shit. Where's that joy yeah. still exists in you? What buoys that? What
yeah. I feel like I've reconnected with it a lot more explicitly recently or like in ways that are a lot more transparent to me. That has maybe always been there, but I love transformation. Mm-hmm. I'm also transgender. So
I was wondering if that was
sense.
A pun.
It was. and I think that something that is still just so like magical and fun and compelling to me mm-hmm. is transformation, mm-hmm. whether that be of me into a character, into another character, into another character, or a stage into a world, or a window display into a play, mm-hmm. or a community into a stronger community. Yeah, nice. I think transformation is the most exciting thing that makes me feel like a giddy child. Mm-hmm. I think about like Taika Waititi and the way that he makes work a lot, and I very much look to him as a role model as a theater artist and just as an artist in general, as someone, because he's said on multiple occasions that like, oh well, film is what works for him right now mm-hmm. as the best medium to express what he's trying to figure out, but it might not always be film, and it hasn't always been film. And I think that like that is really inspiring to me, that I'm like, yeah, theater is really awesome and fun, and obviously the medium that is really working for me right now and has been for a long time, ever since I first thought Keira Knightley was hot. Mm-hmm. But
still is.
Oh, I mean, hotter by the day, probably.
Yeah.
Also, I'm sure very smart. I don't mean to just objectify Keira Knightley.
No,
Keira,
definitely.
If you're listening, I think you're a very cool person who is much more than your looks.
Keira, if you're listening, thank you. Please share.
Share with your networks.
So then I want to ask then, first, before I ask the question, is like I wanted my focus having you on. I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge that my ability to have representatives of the trans community has been lackluster, leaving much to be desired. So that was definitely an impetus here, but
token
I also
trans,
wanted
honey.
To make, but I also wanted to make sure, yes, but yes, yes, no, yes.
I'm a proud token trans hottie. Okay.
Fantastic. Hashtag.
Hashtag. New episode title.
We have so many hashtags
have
for this
a
episode.
A lot of good options.
We do.
Yeah.
I think that last one's my favorite, but also I wanted this to be about, you started this conversation off talking about how you felt as a person, how being an artist mm-hmm. made you feel as a person.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make sure that that was the focus.
Yeah.
Like, just for me as well, because if I'm sitting up here and I'm asking all of these questions from that perspective, which is very much a part of you that should absolutely be elevated and praised, I feel like I'm distracting from what you ended up talking about, which was your personhood. Do you feel that you're allowed that as a performer, as an artist? Or is that being parsed to you in small doses?
Yeah.
Like, are you being given that enough? Are you taking that enough? I find that you
That's
don't suffer
question.
Fools, that you don't suffer...
Except myself.
Well, we all do. I mean, I'm my harshest critic. I stop myself every day.
Mm-hmm.
So... That just, I mean, when we're talking about theater as activism, when we're talking about how it mm-hmm. makes us feel as artists, if we talk about the message that we're trying to have, the yeah. conversation that we're trying to have, we need to be as closely connected to who we are within that moment, separate from the art, mm-hmm. separate from the material, separate from the moment, separate from the blocking, the scene partner, all of that stuff. We have to be as closely connected to that as we are, because if we aren't, the work might still be good. It might still connect with people. It might still matter, but there's a depth that we're not getting to.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, just to help me a little more here,
yeah.
when I was talking about me as a realistic performer. Those are the things that I like to focus on. I'm learning more about immersive theater. The reason why I touched on that was to say this point, and I failed to do it, is that I struggle when I do things that feel outside of the realm of a reality that I am familiar with. And I need it explained to me like I'm a baby sitting in a high chair. It needs to be spoon-fed to me because I don't have it. I don't have the words. I don't have the knowledge. It was, honestly, my school was like, this is the thing we're doing. This is mask work. We're just going to spend 2 weeks on this, and then you're going to do a project in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then after you do that project in 2 weeks, then you're going to learn a scene mm-hmm. and from the Theater of Manners. And yeah. So there was no self-expression, self-exploration through the work. It was just the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that's a whole lot easier, right?
Right.
I'm a cis male. I am Irish. I am Navajo. I am Mexican. Like, I am all of these things, but it's a whole hell of a lot easier for me to experience that world.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine. We've touched on it briefly, and you don't want to go down this road. I totally respect it. But, like, again, wanted to make sure that I saw you first as a person going through your career before I touched on what could is a journey I haven't experienced and won't experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's a few parts of your question that I want to unpack mm-hmm. in some pieces.
Totally.
The first piece is like, do I feel taken care of specifically as a trans person in spaces? No. Mm-hmm. Often no. Sometimes yes. Often no. Mm-hmm. And I usually have to find ways to take care of myself mm-hmm. in those spaces. And sometimes the way that I self-advocate and take care of myself makes people who haven't yet done their own work on unpacking gender or even seeing me as me, it makes them mad and they don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, as a person in the Denver industry in particular, experienced a lot of backlash for simply trying to exist at the same level of visibility and safety and respect as cis people inherently get. Mm. Now, cis asterisk, of course, because there are many intersectional identities that also affect that, right? Anyone who isn't like white, able-bodied, cisgender man has experienced some level of that mm. in different spaces. And speaking to my own experience as a white, Jewish, non-binary trans person, what I usually experience is backlash when I refuse to just accept people not seeing me authentically in the room and not leaving room for my personhood mm. in the space or my dignity that I have a right to the same as everybody else has. Mm. I think things are starting to change. Like, generally, yeah, it's difficult when people haven't done their own work because what sucks as a person who is trans and non-binary, especially at a time in this country where there's so much legislation that is like actively trying to erase you all of the time, is that people see your visibility as a threat to themselves somehow. And it's because they're not used to not inherently having the dignity and respect given to them. And when they see someone having to fight for it, they're like, does that mean that I will have less? Mm. No, spoiler alert. It does not mean that you will have less. It means everyone deserves it. Yes. And yeah, it's that can be hard and tricky sometimes. Mm. And also, like, to be fully accountable, I, of course, have also had moments as a white person, as an able-bodied person who has caused harm because of the ways that I have internalized mm-hmm. white supremacy and ableism and all of these things within our system. And that also takes a lot of, like, sitting with accountability. So by no means is this to say that, like, I'm a perfect little trans angel mm-hmm. and I've never made a mistake ever in my life mm-hmm. and I don't know what it's like to cause harm to other people, because I definitely do, and it sucks. Yeah. It's, like, the hardest thing, honestly, like, worse than being hurt, by other people is knowing that you have hurt other people. Yeah. It is so much harder to sit with that.
Yeah.
And so I think that, like, I would love to invite people to learn, or to at least try to learn, what it feels like to sit with that accountability and to sit with the feeling of, like, I fucked up and I caused harm to someone. Mm-hmm. And what transformation could happen when you just sit with that instead of try to distract yourself from it.
Yeah.
There were more parts to your question, though. It was about personhood, generally in the industry.
Yeah. Have you felt that that was being something that was offered to you regularly? But I think you touched on it. I think you said in certain cases, yes.
Mm-hmm.
There are still pockets, places, people that don't readily know how or are willing to offer that. But then you touched on the fact that it's probably because that work that I was talking about that we need to do as on ourselves to be as present as possible in the moment as a performer is also the same level of work that we need to do on ourselves
as people.
As people. Yep. And the thing that sucks is the system is not really good at encouraging that for any of us.
Right. And the system is something we still have to live under constantly. So even if you did your work today, you're going to have to do it again tomorrow.
Got to keep doing it tomorrow. Absolutely. Yeah. And that is not to say you shouldn't do your work just because it's hard.
No. In fact, the opposite.
Yeah. In fact, because it's hard, absolutely, you have to do it. It's funny. I had that conversation with my mother 35 years ago.
Aww.
Sam, you have to do this work. I was in kindergarten. Let's say 30 years ago, and I was 10. You have to do this homework. But it's hard, but you got to get it done. But it's hard, but you have to get it done,
mm-hmm.
or they'll put you back in the grade that you don't want to be back in anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. You have to do this work. I think you're talking about how, like, taking ownership of where you've crossed a line, where you've harmed.
Mm-hmm.
I know when I've done that.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that is been a one of the things that I really try to work on is how I try to fix it in the moment.
Right.
There's an excessive.
Maybe get defensive, or you're like,
totally.
Oh, no, I didn't mean it that way.
Totally.
Yeah.
No, you didn't hear me. You didn't hear me. No.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and all you can do is be open to the idea that you can be wrong, and that's okay.
Right.
And
yeah.
now I got to learn from that moment.
Right.
We all have different journeys.
Yeah.
But we're all on the same globe,
mm-hmm.
right?
We're all on the same shitty white supremacist colonialist rowboat with holes in the bottom of it.
Ooh.
In the middle of the ocean.
I call that a douche canoe.
Try not to drown. A douche canoe.
Yeah, we're all in the same douche canoe.
We are all in the same douche canoe.
We are.
Episode 101.
Episode 101.
We're all
hashtag
in the same douche canoe.
Douche canoe. We didn't clean this douche canoe. No, no one has for years.
Maybe we should deconstruct the douche canoe and
absolutely.
Build something else.
Yeah. Well, if we deconstruct it now, it's too late because we're on the water.
Because we're going to drown.
We're going to drown. Little bit of poop.
Little
Here,
bit
you
pooping.
Should be a little bit pooping.
Maybe on douche canoe, not so much pooping and more self-exploration. Maybe bring Dude Wipes, our unofficial sponsor.
Dude
Wipes.
Say
the Ghoul Slides podcast sent you here, and they will not give you a discount.
Unnecessarily gendered items. Dude Wipes.
Dude Wipes.
Dude Shampoo.
Dude Shampoo.
And coming soon, Dude Glasses.
That's what I'm wearing right now. Dude Glasses. Samwell.
Sam.
What is that ghost light you'd leave on for that young person sitting in the living room watching Pirates of the Caribbean that you wish was left on for you?
It's okay to do a Keira Knightley monologue when you're in ninth grade.
Hell yeah.
And you don't know what the fuck you're doing. And also, I think the main thing I would want to leave behind is no one can take away your ability to create art, no matter what they say. There is not a single institution, gatekeeper, human being who can actually separate you from your ability to create. Mm. So do it.
Damn straight.
Damn gay.
Touche.
That got me.
Got me. Now that is a pun we can all laugh at. That was well done.
Ha 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 ha.
Maybe a little more. Okay. Well, maybe dial that one back. No, I didn't want that one either. I'm sorry. I'm not going to gatekeep your laugh. You do you.
Yeah, let me create my art, Dad. God.
Don't call me Dad. That is. And on that note.
Don't Call Me Dad, episode 101.
We have another title for this episode. Don't Call Me Dad. Call me Zaddy.
Zaddy.
Anyway. Sam, well, thank you for being a guest on the Ghost Lights podcast.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Ghosties, the artist is Samwell Rose. They are a part of the future of this community, and they are going to tell their story. Dan, do the damn thing. I know I have arrogant diva energy. I will take full ownership of that. I can have that.
Is that? Sorry. Dan, did you fart?
There's a cricket.
Dan
in
just
the
farted.
Theater. We heard a
Does
cricket.
It smell?
The cricket? Yes.
Does it smell bad, or did you just hear a cricket?
I just heard a cricket.
Oh, okay. I didn't.
Why?
Hear
did you also actually fart?
I did not. I think you did. But now I'm really self-conscious.
I think you did.
No, I didn't hear it on the headphones.